Good morning and welcome to Sharper Iron. Spend the next hour with us studying the living and active Word of God, His two-edged sword of law and gospel, recorded for you in Holy Scripture, all about Jesus Christ, crucified, risen, and ascended for you. Thanks for tuning in this morning here on KFUO, Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. I am your host, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. Sharper Iron is underwritten by Lutheran Church Extension Fund. Together in Faith, LCEF helps to start, sustain, and strengthen LCMS ministries through financial and strategic partnerships. Visit lcef.org for more information. On this Friday, March 6th, we're studying Genesis chapter 26, verses 1 to 35. In today's text, the Lord reiterates his promises to Isaac as Isaac interacts with Abimelech, king of the Philistines. To help us sharpen our faith in Christ as we study God's Word today, we have with us regular guest, Pastor Jeremiah Johnson. Pastor Johnson serves at Glory of Christ Lutheran Church in Plymouth, Minnesota. Pastor Johnson, welcome back to Sharper Iron.
Thanks. Always good to be here, Pastor Apple.
As we get started today, remind us of the context. What do we need to know as we prepare to look at Genesis 26?
Right. History just kind of keeps on plugging along. So let's just think about what just happened. We had kind of the tail end of Abraham's life. You know, Sarah already died. You know, he marries Keturah. And remember, Abraham, this will be kind of important later on to keep in mind the time frame we're talking about. You know, Isaac is, what is he? He's born when Abraham's 100 years old. And Abraham lives like another, 50 some years. And so then we have all the sons of Ishmael. They're all listed. And then we have finally the much more familiar stories of the birth of Jacob and Esau, two nations wrangling in their mother's womb, and then Esau selling his birthright for a bowl of porridge, and then we get this chapter, and it's like it's the stuff in the movie that you need to set the backdrop, but nobody's super excited about. So,
you know, this chapter is one of the chapters of Genesis that's perhaps a little less known than others, mm-hmm. which is, I find, somewhat ironic because Isaac is the main actor in this text. And we've noted this already because Isaac's been around for a while in the book of Genesis. But in terms of being the main actor of a text, he really doesn't do all that much other than this chapter. He's certainly involved in other events throughout the book of Genesis where he's alive. But in terms of being the main player of the story, this is where he does the majority of, you know, his action in the text. You know, in the other places, Abraham tends to be more the main character, or his sons, mm-hmm. Esau and Jacob, tend to be more the main character. But here, you know, he's the guy, and yet this is the chapter that we maybe know the least when it comes to stories that involve Isaac. I don't know what to make of that.
I actually think it seems fitting, though, because even though he is the main character, he's not really even that active if you look at it.
Sure.
I mean, you know, Abimelech is, you know, much more active, and it's about his servants and all these, but probably most importantly, it's God. Right. And so I think probably amongst other things that, you know, that the actions of God are really being highlighted, and God's faithfulness to Isaac, as you already said in your intro, that's really what's, I think, on highlight here. I mean, don't get me wrong. I think Isaac, there's a lot of really helpful things here. I think especially because Isaac doesn't actually end up contending with the Philistines, but we're getting ahead of ourselves. So
Sure. And I think we said it this way in a previous episode, that Isaac, in terms of the narrative, seems to be less important for what he does and more important for who he is, that he is the promised child. He highlights the faithfulness of God's promises, and that's true regardless of the various actions you might see him take or not see him take, which again seem to be less recorded than his father Abraham and his son Jacob. And yet, the Lord is still always identified the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. So he remains a central figure, even if you don't see him, quote, do a lot, at least as much as his father or son.
Right.
Yeah. So we get to take a look at some of the things that he does do and that happened to him in Genesis chapter 26 today. We start at the first verse. Now there was a famine in the land, besides the former famine that was in the days of Abraham. And Isaac went to Gerar to Abimelech, king of the Philistines. And the Lord appeared to him and said, "Do not go down to Egypt. Dwell in the land of which I shall tell you. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with you and will bless you. For to you and to your offspring I will give all these lands, and I will establish the oath that I swore to Abraham your father. I will multiply your offspring as the stars of heaven, and will give to your offspring all these lands. And in your offspring all the nations of the earth shall be blessed, because Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statutes, and my laws." And I'll pause there at the end of verse 5. Isaac will take action on those words of God in the following verses. Pastor, we've noted already many times in the book of Genesis how patterns tend to repeat themselves. And so we've seen famines before. Moses even tells us that this is right. Another famine in addition to the former one. And in that context, the Lord speaks to Isaac. Take us into this opening part of the text.
Right. And I think it's nice because the sense of deja vu you can get is really quite intentional. Right. With the reference to Abraham and it's, in the promises with respect to Abraham, I mean, in verse 3, it says God himself even makes reference to it. And I will establish the oath that I swore to Abraham, your father. And he ends up repeating all these. I think in the big picture, the takeaway from this first portion is almost as if, like, if we, the readers, were asking, like, so. All right, so Abraham's dead. Is the promise still good? Because that's what everything hinges on, right? I mean, I think sometimes we forget that that's the big tension all throughout the book of Genesis. That once God drops this promise on Abraham, we have to ask, like, at every moment, because if the Messiah is actually going to be from Abraham's line, right? And if all the nations are going to be blessed, I mean, there's a lot hanging in the balance here. And so, it seems appropriate for us, sort of as the audience, so to speak, to always be asking, is he going to make it good? Is he going to make it good? Is he going to make it good? And that's the tension all the way along. And God keeps dropping these hints over and over again, as if we were asking it out loud. And so when he reaffirms this, and certainly for Isaac's own sake, right? I mean, I could only imagine, if you think about it, Isaac is in a very, very similar place to Abraham, right? God promises to Abraham, hey, all this land's going to be yours. Oh, by the way, there's a famine now, and you got to leave this place. If I were Isaac, I'd be like, or if I were Abraham, I would have said, well, am I going to make it back here? I mean, what kind of promise is this, right? It's like, I'm going to give you this house. Oh, but you can't have it yet. You're going to have to wait several hundred years before you get it, right? And I think likewise with Isaac, here he is. He's living sort of closer to ground zero of the promised land, only once again forced to leave it. It reminds me very much of, the book of Hebrews, that famous chapters about living by faith, not by sight, right? With chapter 11 following. I think this is also where we come in as well, or at least an easy application for us, that just as Isaac had these tremendous promises that were continuously being reinforced by God, we need the same thing. I mean, and to be honest, that's what Sunday morning is, isn't it? Mm. Sunday morning is like what verses, this is like God showing up to us and telling us yet one more time, because we need to hear it, like, hey, I'm good for all those promises I gave you to, through my son, that you're my adopted children, that you have the promise of everlasting life, and that you have the inheritance of, an eternal heavens and earth, which he's promising to us. We look around and it's a little bit like there's a famine in the land, right? I mean, not to get too metaphorical on it, but, you look outside and like, this place doesn't look like Eden, right? And I could imagine asking the same question that maybe Abraham or Isaac would have, like, Lord, are you sure? Like, are you really making good on this? And he keeps on reminding us, yes, it is going to happen. It just takes time, his time.
Sure. Yeah, and I think one thing that does stand out as a difference between this text and when we saw Abraham leave due to a famine mm-hmm. is that here the Lord specifically tells Isaac, don't go to Egypt.
Right.
We right. talked a little bit about that when Abraham went to Egypt, whether or not he should have, was that a faithful thing or not? And the text doesn't indicate one way or another. Mm-hmm. Either way, the Lord blessed Abraham in Egypt. just like we're going to see him do for Isaac here. But I think the fact that the Lord specifies to Isaac, don't go to Egypt, is a reminder that the promise is good, even at this moment when the famine maybe seems like, oh, maybe the promise isn't good. The specificity of don't go to Egypt, you know, stick around close, like that, I think, is only re-emphasizes the promise God is making.
Right. And let's not also forget that all throughout the Old Testament, fleeing to Egypt, right, for safety or security becomes kind of like this ongoing temptation for the Israelites. You think about, for example, after they leave Egypt, like even while they're still, right, while they're still trekking through the desert, they say, oh, if we only went back to Egypt, right, we had the melons and the cucumbers and the leeks and all those other weird things that, you know, we don't really, yeah, that we Hebrew students have a hard time translating, right? But they always keep on going back to, like, oh, look at how great we had it in Egypt. But if you remember later on, like when they're being oppressed by the Assyrians and later also the Babylonians, they frequently appeal to Egypt. And the Lord keeps on telling them through the prophets, like, listen, don't appeal to the Egyptians. They're going to be, number one, they're not going to be able to save you. Number two, you've essentially sold your soul then. And I wonder if maybe perhaps this is a little bit of foreshadowing of the continual temptation to put their trust in the wrong place, namely Egypt.
Yeah, I agree that, and I think, again, regardless of whether Abraham was right or wrong when he went to Egypt, the fact that the Lord specifies it to Isaac here is a reminder, or as you said, a foreshadowing. It's a reminder to those who have already read the whole story that right. To go to Egypt for safety is ultimately not the right move. It's going to be the Lord who's going to provide safety. And even in those moments where, you know, I mean, as we see later in the book of Genesis, the Lord provides for his people in Egypt through Joseph, even then it becomes the place of danger eventually from which the Lord right. will need to set them free. And so
even Moses has to flee from it, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So to see that the Lord gives that warning already ahead of time is an indication of how the story's going to go. And again, we've seen that so many times in the book of Genesis, where something that happens is a theme, an action that God will take again and again, all of it ultimately pointing to our Lord Jesus Christ, who does end up going to Egypt, and mm-hmm. the Lord rescues him from there. So that right. that theme, you know, just is going to play itself out throughout the rest of the Bible. Anything else in those first five verses, the Lord's promise to Isaac, before we move on to more of the text?
No, we've got a lot of stuff to go. So let's forge ahead.
Yes, and I do think it's just worth noting, this is how the text begins, an important reminder. Isaac is going with the promises of God, and that's going to set the background for everything else that happens in this chapter. So we pick up again at verse 6 of Genesis 26. So Isaac settled in Gerar. When the men of the place asked him about his wife, he said, "She is my sister," for he feared to say, "my wife," thinking, "lest the men of the place should kill me because of Rebekah," because she was attractive in appearance. When he had been there a long time, Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out of a window and saw Isaac laughing with Rebekah, his wife. So Abimelech called Isaac and said, "Behold, she is your wife. How then could you say, 'She is my sister'?" Isaac said to him, "Because I thought, lest I die because of her." Abimelech said, "What is this you have done to us? One of the people might easily have lain with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us." So Abimelech warned all the people, saying, "Whoever touches this man or his wife shall surely be put to death." And Isaac sowed in that land and reaped in the same year 100-fold. The Lord blessed him, and the man became rich and gained more and more until he became very wealthy. He had possessions of flocks and herds and many servants, so that the Philistines envied him. Now the Philistines had stopped and filled with earth all the wells that his father's servant had dug in the days of Abraham his father. And Abimelech said to Isaac, "Go away from us, for you are much mightier than we." I think I'll pause there at verse 16. So again, deja vu all over again. Is that Yogi Berra? Is that a Yogi Berra?
Yeah, Yogi Berra.
Yeah. So here we go again with, like, father, like son, I suppose, is the other cliche you might use here. Talk to us about what Isaac does when he goes to Gerar.
Right. If this all sounds familiar, that's because it is. You know, as we were talking about before we even started with this, Abraham's done this twice already. I think most people remember usually when Abraham goes down to Egypt and he says, "Oh yeah, you know, Sarah's my sister," and you know, and then Pharaoh takes her, and then you know, the plagues affect him. But then Even I have kind of forgotten until I looked at this text again that Abraham does it a second time in Gerar with Abimelech. Now, we'll go ahead and get this little debate out of the way right away. So Abraham was in Gerar way back when. I mean, it's probably, this was even before Isaac was born.
Right.
And so it's got to be, what, like 75 years, maybe 100 years, I think I read in a commentary. So this is a long time. And right. And it's possible, though, that a lot of the commentaries will say Abimelech, and this is a common thing in the ancient world, where Abimelech either, he's like Abimelech Jr., or he's got his dad's name, or he decided to take his dad's name. Right. And so this is quite likely two different kings. Right. But I mean, but they're, they're probably related, and sure. I mean, almost certainly. They've got deja vu too.
Yeah, absolutely. Could it be, and I don't know if this is what the commentary suggests, but how like all the kings of Egypt are all called Pharaoh. Could Abimelech be a royal title, perhaps?
That's possible as well. In fact, even that same issue comes up with the commander, Phicol, because he's got to be getting to be an old dude. I mean, if it's the same guy, but I would think more than likely that could even just be almost like a title. Here's the thing is that we can't know for sure, but in the end, I think the likely candidate is I'm guessing it's probably Abimelech the first son, or maybe they're all Abimelech, whatever it is. But the point is that Abraham did this, and then also Isaac is doing it as well. Now, I do want to go, though, just for a second before we totally, it's wrong. It's wrong for him to do this. He lies to them. It's deceptive.
Right.
It's kind of cowardly, but I do at least want us to have a little bit of empathy for him, because I think we should remember, number one, Isaac is a stranger in a strange land, right? He's, he's sort of in maybe not enemy territory, but he's not one of the Philistines. And so it was a little bit of the Wild West back then. He doesn't have, there's no human rights watch that's going to be protecting him. He doesn't have protected status in any way. And so so he is, I think, very legitimately concerned about this. And the fact that both he and Abraham kind of repeat the same fear, that they're going to kill me and take my wife. Were they just paranoid, or were they getting this because this was a thing that would often happen? I really think it's the latter. I think this was a very real possibility when everybody did what was right in their own eyes, right? And there's no, and especially if you're dealing with the king, right? You're on his property and he can pretty much do what he wants. And so at least to give a little bit of sympathy for Isaac, we shouldn't totally throw him under the bus, that there's a real risk he's trying to mitigate. Now, this is obviously not the way he should have done this. He should have actually trusted the Lord. The Lord's given him a promise. And so this is definitely not a shiny moment for Isaac. That's true too. But maybe even that is a really helpful thing for us to be reminded of, that the patriarchs aren't superheroes.
Yeah.
That, even though, yes, they are commended, both the Old and the New Testament as being men of renown, it's not as if, and it's certainly, as we've seen with Abraham already, that they're not without fault. The Lord doesn't pick perfect people because there aren't any to pick from, well, except for Jesus. So,
that's right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think your description of the environment in which Abraham and Isaac both lived in, again, not to excuse what they did, but rather just to understand, this was not a safe place to go and dwell. I mean, you think about another example from the Old Testament that maybe comes to mind is the way that King David behaves with Bathsheba at the beginning of 2 Samuel 11, when he just takes her for his wife. That's kind of the way that the kings of the ancient Near East would always act. And so, again, it doesn't make what Abraham and Isaac do right, but I think it maybe allows us to understand where they're coming from a little bit more, as you pointed out. Not that we would imitate that, but rather just to say, oh, this was a very dangerous situation they were living in. And I also think it also makes the point that it's not necessarily only like father like son, but rather like win in Rome, do as the Romans do, another cliche out there. It's almost more like that, where you kind of wonder if this was just a thing that people did to try to keep themselves from, from having family members killed or themselves killed. Again, not to say that it's right, but this is seems to be sort of the way of the world. I suppose if that is the case, then the way that Abimelech reacts when he realizes the truth and learns it from Isaac, that Rebekah is actually Isaac's wife, the fact that he doesn't just take her as his own anyway, I don't know that I would, it doesn't show him to be righteous, but he's got a conscience, I guess.
Right. Yeah. I'm really glad you brought that up because I wanted to talk about that. I still don't know quite what to make of Abimelech, but then again, I think this betrays all of our tendencies to like carve up everybody in the Old Testament as good guys and bad guys. Right. Sure. And it's just not that simple, but I mean, you gotta have at least some respect for this guy because first, right, he recognizes and acknowledges essentially the sixth commandment, right? That it would have been wrong. I mean, he says it in this really strong terms. He says, you know, one of the people might get easily lain with your wife. I wonder if he's kind of like one of the people, like kind of in air quotes, like talking about himself, perhaps, and he says, lain you with the wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us. And so one thing I think we should not get the sense of is like, yeah, I mean, it may have been kind of the Wild West in terms of, you know, in terms of might makes right, but at the same time, they did have a sense of morality. And so here's this pagan king who, you know, and as we can't help but think about it, the fact that he is a Philistine, and they're eventually going to be, you know, sort of the arch enemies of the Israelites. Here he is being, at least to some extent, noble, only further amplified by the fact that he says, hey, whoever touches this man, man or his wife shall surely be put to death. I mean, this is, and we recognize, especially with in the close context of God's promise, this is God's hand behind all of this. I think it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. We can attribute this to the Lord working through even this pagan king in order to fulfill his promises and safeguard, you know, Abraham's line. But I do think, though, that, I mean, contrast this with maybe with Pharaoh, right? Mm. Here's a man who is willing to sort of actually respect Abimelech, or respect Isaac. And so part of me really wants to kind of, want to see Abimelech as being kind of more of a good guy, you know, even though he's still clearly a pagan, because there's going to be some other things he'll do later on that, yeah, they're self-serving, but they seem morally upright.
Yeah, one of the differences in this text versus what happened with Abimelech in Genesis chapter 20 was in Genesis chapter 20, it was the Lord himself who came to Abimelech and told him, you know, this is Abraham's wife, don't do anything, or the curse that had already begun on them, that the wombs of the women of Abimelech's household were all barren, that was going to continue. So you have the Lord revealing it directly in Genesis 20. There's no record of that here. I do think either way, though, whether it did happen, it's just not recorded, or there was a silence about it from God, that it is the Lord behind it all, preserving his promise to Isaac. I think that's absolutely right.
Right. And I think I'm glad you brought that up, because that I probably should tweak something I said a little bit then, that I don't want to give too much credit to kind of like the moral upstandingness of this, because I think the likelihood, if the off chance that you know, the Abimelech that Abraham runs into is the same one as Isaac, then it's definitely clear, like, where did he learn this kind of morality? It was directly from God. But even let's say it's his son, right? Do you think they never had that conversation? Sure. Like, hey, son, why, you know, God showed up to me one day and told me this thing. You think that would be a memorable thing you might want to pass on to your kids? Right. And so I think it's entirely plausible that one way or another, this response by Abimelech is actually prompted by, you know, God's own appearance to Abimelech either earlier on in his life or, you know, or to his father or predecessor, whoever it is.
Agreed. And particularly, you know, with the wombs being closed in chapter 20, then this is huge speculation. But if this Abimelech is the child of the first Abimelech, you know, right after that event of Genesis chapter 20 happened, certainly, you would expect a story like that to get passed on within the family. And even if it's not that close of a connection, I think you're exactly right. We should expect that an event like that would have been related in some way through the family, such that the response of this Abimelech in chapter 26, while perhaps a little surprising, isn't completely out of the blue, given that they've had interactions with the true God in the past. There's another detail in here, and I'm not sure, again, what to make of this other than just to note it. The name Isaac means laughter, and it does strike me that, and when you look at the text, the words are related, that Abimelech saw Isaac laughing with Rebekah. Right. And so the word laughter just keeps popping up around Isaac in his life. I don't know that's other important other than if you know the Hebrew, it's kind of interesting to look at. But
it's a fun thing. I don't know. Yeah. I'm not sure what to make of it either. But I mean, the commentators do note, and it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure this out, like the laughter may imply maybe a little bit more intimacy than just like, oh, they're sitting back and having a glass of wine on top of their, you know, like outside or something like that, noticing that they're having a good time. I mean, but that's all, you know, it just, I think that observation is usually driven by the fact that, like, just if it's just laughter, that doesn't seem to be enough to conclude for Abimelech to conclude that she's more than just his sister.
Sure.
So,
sure.
But yeah, anyway.
I was just pointing out that, you know, Isaac continues to be a man of laughter. His birth was surrounded with laughter. His marriage is surrounded with laughter. He's kind of identified as the laughter one. And you know, he receives
he's the laughter patriarch, promise. Right?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, he's the patriarch of joy and laughter, perhaps. So that takes us through verse 11. We're going to take our break and keep looking at this text more on the other side. You're listening to Sharper Iron on KFUO. We're talking to Pastor Jeremiah Johnson this morning. We'll be right back. Please stick around.
Did you know that an investment with Lutheran Church Extension Fund exclusively supports LCMS ministries and church workers? That's right. LCEF ensures LCMS churches, schools, and organizations have access to the financial resources they need to sustain, strengthen, and start ministry work. In other words, you can feel good investing with LCEF because we share your Lutheran values and love for the church. Learn more at lcef.org.
LCF is a nonprofit religious organization. Therefore, LCF investments are not FDIC-insured bank deposit accounts. This is not an offer to sell investments or solicitation to buy. LCF will offer and sell its securities only in states where authorized. The offer is made solely by LCF's offering circular. Investors should carefully read the offering circular, which more fully describes associated risks.
Welcome back to Sharper Iron. It is Friday, March 6th. We're studying Genesis chapter 26, verses 1 to 35 with Pastor Jeremiah Johnson. He serves at Glory of Christ Lutheran Church in Plymouth, Minnesota. Pastor, prior to the break, we were talking about Abimelech, who has recognized now and learned for sure that Rebekah is Isaac's wife. And you know, he has a conscience. He's not going to do anything. And then he gives the command to his all of his people, you know, this, and notice not just whoever touches this man's wife, but whoever touches this man. So despite, you know, this deception that Isaac has worked upon him, again, like we saw with Abraham and Abimelech, the Lord brought blessing to Isaac, which is certainly brought out in the next paragraph, verses 12 to 16. So talk about how we said at the outset, the Lord is faithful. That's the theme of this chapter.
Right.
Even with Isaac showing a deceptive side, the Lord still blesses him there in the land of Abimelech.
Right. I mean, I think it's not just a matter of like he's lining his pockets. I think this is really a description of how he's becoming a great nation. Right. And so certainly, and keep in mind that when they talk about people becoming wealthy and great in the ancient world, that's almost entirely in terms of, you know, the size of your household and the size of your flocks, or even, you know, the grain that you produce and whatnot. But I mean, you know, nowadays we want to know like, well, what's your net worth? I mean, you remember Job, his entire wealth was described as how many servants does he have and how many animals does he have, right? And that's similarly here, but I bring that point up, not just as a historical point of interest, but about the fact that essentially as his household becomes larger and larger. I mean, he is sort of approaching nation status in a way. And I mean, even that's illustrated by the fact that it seems like the folks in Gerar are getting a little frightened of him. I mean, we saw the same thing with Abraham, right? He has a personal army at his disposal. So when Lot is, when he's taken captive, right? I mean, Abraham can go and rescue him from that. He's kind of like recognized as being sort of an independent nation in and of himself. And I think that same thing is also happening with Isaac as well. A couple of quick geographical notes, by the way. We are in southern Canaan at this point, what's usually called the Negev. Gerar is closer to the coast where the Philistine cities are, and and he's kind of moving then. He moves from Gerar into the valley of Gerar, which is probably just the larger surrounding area. And eventually he's going to move further east on from there. But we're all start talking about, these are not major moves. These are all relatively small moves, a couple of, dozen miles at most. But the real key thing is, why does he move? He becomes wealthy, and it specifically says the Philistines envied him. Now, that may or may not have included Abimelech. At some point in time later on, we're going to see how Abimelech seems to be intimidated by his success and his little wondering. He says, it's better make friends with you than have you as enemies, but we'll get to that. But I think what's really interesting about all of this, as we see it all unfold, is to look at why they become envious of Isaac. And I think there's real opportunities for us to reflect upon, frankly, our own struggle with contentment and in our envy of one another. Let's talk about that after we talk about the series of wells, but I just want to plant that seed.
Let's go ahead and read a little bit more then. We've already heard that the Philistines are stopping and filling with earth wells that had been dug in Abraham's day. And the theme of wells continues as the chapter progresses. So let's read a little bit farther along, starting again at verse 17 of the chapter. So Isaac departed from there and encamped in the valley of Gerar and settled there. And Isaac dug again the wells of water that had been dug in the days of Abraham his father, which the Philistines had stopped after the death of Abraham. And he gave them the names that his father had given them. But when Isaac's servants dug in the valley and found there a well of spring water, the herdsmen of Gerar quarreled with Isaac's herdsmen, saying, "The water is ours." So he called the name of the well Essek, because they contended with him. Then they dug another well, and they quarreled over that also. So he called its name Sitnah. And he moved from there and dug another well, and they did not quarrel over it. So he called its name Rehoboth, saying, "For now the Lord has made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land." All right, we'll pause there again at verse 22. So this theme of wells, also something very important in the story of Abraham, continues right in the story of Isaac. We've learned that the Philistines are stopping up wells that Abraham had dug, and now Isaac's digging more wells and renaming them according to his father, and the herdsmen of Gerar, they're quarreling with Isaac. I will say, I guess this goes with one thing you said earlier about Isaac and his wealth. I think it's easy sometimes when you read this section of Genesis just to think about Isaac and Rebekah and their two kids, and this little family of four is just moving around. This is a whole, I mean, almost a nation isn't quite right yet,
right.
And city-state isn't quite, but this is a large contingent of people that's moving around. And the Philistines clearly see them as a threat if they're stopping up wells rather than just saying, get out of here sort of thing. This matter that the wells are that important in terms of stopping them up, that's not a small action to stop up a well, particularly at this time.
Yeah, and it says they actually filled it with earth. And I wanted to sort of give the Philistines a benefit of the doubt. And I did my best to research this a little bit, and I could not find a legitimate reason why you'd want to stop up a well. Even if it ran dry, then it just becomes a cistern, and there's plenty of those all throughout the Middle East. But it almost seems for sure that this is a vindictive kind of move, that they did not, they could have even used the wells themselves, but they dopped up the ones that Abraham dug. I don't know what the rules would have been about that. If you did, like, if you did the well, is it yours? I mean, how do you have jurisdiction over that? I'm not sure exactly how it works, but I think one thing we do need to remember is that, you know, like the dollars in my wallet, they don't need care. They just sit there, right? Mm. But wealth in the ancient world needs to be fed and watered, right. Right? Your sheep, they need water. And if you don't have it for a day or two, you know, like you die. This was really impressed upon me. I remember in seminary, I went hiking with a good friend of mine up in the Smoky Mountains, and we were backpacking. And so we weren't going back to a base camp. And the one thing I just hadn't thought that much about, but thankfully he thought about it. You know, he started showing us our route, and he said, well, we're going to hit this river, and then we're going to hit this spring, and then we're going to hit this one as well. Because if you can't always go back to a water fountain, like you have to plan your travels around water sources, and how easy it is for us to forget, you know, all of us who have indoor plumbing, that this was a major concern during the day. You can go a couple of days without food. You can't go a couple of days without water. And so, these are absolute necessities for life itself. And so for Isaac, I think it was really interesting that Isaac doesn't actually fight for these wells, that he just lets them. It just seems like he lets them go. He doesn't want to show a big stink about it. And he moves on, he digs another one, and that one gets contested. He finally digs another one, and that one doesn't get contested. I think it shows Isaac in a pretty good light. I mean, at the very least, that maybe he really is just trusting that God's going to provide, and he doesn't want to make a big stink with all of the folks. But maybe this is a good time to return back to that theme of like envy and covetousness, because it got me thinking about the fact that it doesn't report the Philistines having envy for Isaac until they see how much he has. And I just thought that so much resonates with our own experience. You know, how much do we become discontent only when we see when our neighbor has more, right? It kind of reminds me of a statement that Luther said, and I'm paraphrasing it here, but we're so bad, we can't even stand it when our neighbor has good things. And you think about this, and this is like, this is exactly how social media works, right? that we, you know, we become, you know, we cue our desires off of when people demonstrate what they have, right? You know, and I think we see this very, very clearly with our own kids. I'm not throwing my own kids under the bus, but just generally kids, that they didn't know that they wanted something until they saw that somebody else had it. Right. And I wonder how much of us, you know, how much more content we would be if actually we just didn't know, you know, we see people advertising that, you know, their fancy cars, or the fact that they lost all this weight, or, you know, or they've got this great job, or blah, 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 whatever else everybody has, or maybe more to the point, that we would simply be able to rejoice in what our neighbor has rather than how perverting that into our own desires and saying, well, how come I don't have that? Right. So,
well, and in that context, then Isaac's actions, that he just kind of keeps moving along, digging new wells, I think stands out even in sharper contrast, because he responds to the envy and covetousness of others toward him with, you know, just contentment himself rather than, you know, like making a thing of it. He keeps moving along and looking for the Lord to fulfill his promise. If I say this about Isaac, you know, if you think about Abraham's story being a seesaw of faithfulness and less faithfulness, we're seeing it all from Isaac within this one chapter, you know, of the ups and downs, less faithfulness, passing his wife off as his sister, but I think a lot more faithfulness here, trusting the Lord to provide even something as, you know, something that could be as, that is as scarce as water and potentially, you know, something you're more likely to covet. Here he is trusting the Lord to give daily bread.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's going to be, we're really going to put an exclamation point on that as we see the agreement that he makes with Abimelech and, you know, and the other national representatives who are going to come to him. So, but
The names of these wells, just typically in Hebrew, this is pretty normal that the names mean something, it sounds like.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, the I mean, you could read your footnotes in your Bible. You know, esek, you know, means like you know, something like contention, and you know, sitna means means quarreling. Or but it clearly they're clearly there to indicate. Rehoboth is kind of interesting because it kind of means like roomy, meaning that like there's room for all of us. It means kind of like a broad space. You know, but I thought what was really interesting. But full disclosure, I don't know what to make of it. He goes and he renames all of Abraham's wells with the same names. Like, I feel like there's something more profound to that, but I'm not sure what to make of it. I don't know if you had any thoughts on it.
I don't know, other than perhaps to say that the faith that Abraham has passed down to his son has stuck, even in
continuity,
in the naming. Yeah, that's about the best that I can do with it in terms of a theological significance to it. It's probably not too surprising to see a son name things similarly to his father. You know, I mean, I know I say things that are very similar to the way I heard my dad say them growing up, but perhaps a theological or the continuity of faith, that might be something to say, but that's about all I know to say on that. So let's keep reading. So we get the Lord speaking to Isaac yet again. I'm going to go ahead and read the rest of the chapter for us so that we can just discuss it at our leisure. From there, he Isaac, went up to Beersheba, and the Lord appeared to him the same night and said, "I am the God of Abraham, your father. Fear not, for I am with you and will bless you and multiply your offspring for my servant Abraham's sake." So he built an altar there and called upon the name of the Lord and pitched his tent there. And there Isaac's servants dug a well. When Abimelech went to him from Gerar with Ahuzath, his advisor, and Phicol, the commander of his army, Isaac said to them, "Why have you come to me, seeing that you hate me and have sent me away from you?" They said, "We see plainly that the Lord has been with you. So we said, let there be a sworn pact between us, between you and us, and let us make a covenant with you, that you will do us no harm, just as we have not touched you, and have done to you nothing but good, and have sent you away in peace. You are now the blessed of the Lord." So he made them a feast, and they ate and drank. In the morning they rose early and exchanged oaths. And Isaac sent them on their way, and they departed from him in peace. That same day Isaac's servants came and told him about the well that they had dug, and said to him, "We have found water." He called it Sheba. Therefore the name of the city is Beersheba to this day. When Esau was 40 years old, he took Judith, the daughter of Beri the Hittite, to be his wife, and Basemath, the daughter of Eli the Hittite, and they made life bitter for Isaac and Rebekah. And that's where our chapter ends today. So verses 23 to 25, Pastor Johnson, the Lord speaks to Isaac yet again, as we saw in the beginning of the chapter. What does the Lord tell him here in the middle of the chapter?
Right. It seems like it's once again another affirmation of the very kind of like a shortened version of the promises that he confirmed. But I think it's really worthwhile noting that it's in Beersheba, which, if you recall, is titled that because, once again, that we have deja vu here, because Abraham originally went to Beersheba. And I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, that's where Abimelech, the prior, Abraham's right. Abimelech, made a promise with him there, and that's why it was originally called Beersheba. And so we have kind of like two of the three main covenantal promises repeated here, right? I'll bless you and I will multiply your offspring. I think it's so interesting, for my servant Abraham's sake. So again, Abraham is being invoked. I mean, not to say that, it's not to say that Isaac isn't also part of the line, but it's abundantly clear that this is one big continuous promise, first given to his father Abraham, but now likewise, to him as well. He says, because he says, "I am the God of your Abraham, your father. Fear not, for I am with you. I am with you." And so it's not, I think it could be easily misread as he's not just, God isn't just confirming like, "Well, I really like that guy Abraham, and you, well, maybe because your dad was so great, I'll be nice to you." He says, "I am with you." And so in many ways, I think this might be just a touch on the speculative side, but I do know that some commentators will note this. Later on, Isaac responds to all of this by setting up an altar And, you know, and it says, and he calls upon the name of the Lord there. And so I think this is really the sign where, if I can, for lack of a better term, where we clearly see this sign that, yes, he's not just the God of Abraham. He's also the God of Isaac. Not to say like Isaac made him his own, which is not, you know, God's the one who actually came to him. But there is a certain sense of Isaac acknowledging him as his God as well. And so I think there's almost like a certain formality to all of this.
Yeah, I think so. And the importance of Beersheba in the Old Testament continues. We noted that previously, that Beersheba is just an important place going forward, even out of the book of Genesis. And so we continue to see how it is important to God's people all along, including Abraham's son, Isaac. So this is happening in Beersheba, and Beersheba once again becomes a place of an oath for now Isaac, the son of Abraham, and Abimelech, likely the son of the other Abimelech. We meet another advisor, which I'm not going to try to say again, of Abimelech.
Just say it real fast.
That's right. So Abimelech's got two of his people with him, his advisor and the commander of his army this time. And well, there's a little bit of back and forth between Isaac and Abimelech when it comes to this oath that is made. Take us into that scene.
Yeah, I think it's so interesting to try. I mean, some of this is going to end up being speculation because you can't read psychologically too much into all of it, but it sure seems curious. Because first, I mean, when he comes to him, Isaac accuses them, or at least he's under the impression that they hate him. And so on the one hand, you will kind of wonder, what do you make of this? Because Abimelech clearly seems to say in the very next statement, like, oh, no, you got this all wrong, right? We don't hate you. But you do get the sense that here he comes with like an official delegation to make sure this all goes well. I mean, he's kind of, whether or not Abimelech is like really faithful and how much he's like honoring God himself and acknowledging Isaac as, you know, a genuine, you know, a prophet and someone who is, who really has been blessed by God. You gotta give Abimelech some credit. This is a pretty politically savvy thing to do. Here's this guy who's up and coming. He seems to be a threat to you. That's clearly already established, because the narrator tells us that. And so this seems like a pretty politically savvy move to do. And once again, this is deja vu. He did the exact same thing with Abraham, or his predecessor did it with Abraham. I mean, if I were in his place, yeah, I'd want to do this because you want to make sure to a guy who could basically become a military threat to your own city. Yeah, you want to make sure that you're on good speaking terms with him. Now, how much of this is only political? How much of it is genuine? I don't know. It's hard to say. But clearly, Isaac seems to be under the impression that he was hated by them, and Abimelech wants to He wants to change his impression about that.
Yeah, and again, without knowing anything about the motivations of the people involved, particularly in the sight of Abimelech, perhaps one of the things that we can see is the keeping of God's promise that it is through the line of this offspring, Isaac, that all the nations will be blessed. And even if Abimelech and his companions don't realize that theologically, Lord makes good on the promise that he will actually bless Abimelech and his people in their connection to Isaac in a faithful way, rather than as we saw at the beginning of the chapter, if there's adultery, the Lord's going to bring that for harm upon Abimelech. But here with the treaty, again, without the motivations, knowing them, either way, the Lord, I think, shows faithfulness to that promise to bless people through the line of Abraham.
Right. And that makes me wonder, because I completely agree with that. Does Isaac's response, you know, after they kind of go back and forth a little bit and they say, we sent you away in peace, you're blessed of the Lord, that's all great. And so what does Isaac do? He throws them a feast. I'm not sure that was absolutely necessary. And so, I mean, so here's one of the possibilities. Does Isaac throw them this feast because, you know, this is how he enacts the promise that God gave to him, that he would be a blessing to the other nations? Like how self-aware is Isaac when he does this? Because it may not be, maybe this seems like a small thing to us, But here he's hosting official representatives of the, of the city of Gerar, the king himself. And, and he actually makes them a feast. And I don't know what the social expectations would have been, in that regard. I don't know if that would have been seen as a necessary part, but if it's something that is kind of gratis that Isaac is doing, he's blessing the nations. He's doing exactly what God promised that he would do. So I don't know. I don't know if that's tell me, is that reading into this too much, or is that just pious thought?
I'm not sure. Abraham interacts with Abimelech twice in Genesis 20 and then in 21. So the matter of the treaty is now in Genesis 21, although certainly I think the events are connected to each other in some way. And there you do have Abraham giving these seven ewe lambs mm-hmm. to Abimelech in that text, which could also be part of the play on Beersheba, a well or a well of seven. So it's not, I suppose the feast, I think, falls in line with that. But I think your observation still remains, regardless of if Isaac does it for the social customs and economic and legal customs of his day, or if he does it in a little more self-aware way. I think either way, the Lord, being the actor behind all of this, is making good on his promise
Absolutely.
To bless nations. Still,
right.
The whole time. Now,
whether or not he or Abraham, for that matter, are aware of it, that doesn't stop the Lord from actually being faithful.
That's right. So the chapter then ends, because we got about 3 minutes here, so we should talk about the end of this chapter, which I think helps
it is,
and it's one of those places where I suppose maybe verses 34 and 35 of this chapter go a little more with what happens in the next, but it's an important note regardless of where you read it, that Esau turns 40 and he marries two women, both of whom are daughters of the Hittites. And Moses even tells us that this makes life bitter for his parents. So, again, this sets the stage for things to come. Take us into those last two verses.
Right. Well, let me give you the comparison I thought of right away that at least helps us envision kind of the contrast that this really provides. It sort of reminds me of I can't remember who said it to me, but a Christmas letter once that I read about a family. And I don't know if you've ever received one like this, but you can tell who the golden child is in the family. And then there's three lines about the one kid who's sort of the black sheep at the end. And he got a new job out in San Diego or something like that. But anyway, and you can kind of read between the lines of this is the son who we're not as proud about. But it explicitly says it that, it's difficult to tell what's the main issue. Is it that he took these two wives? But clearly the big problem is the fact that they are both Hittite women, right? Mm. These are part of the nations that are going to be displaced, by Abraham. And here now he's married foreigners. And if you remember the whole reason why, Sarah sends Isaac, away to, to get married to Rebecca, or I'm trying to, I always get that confused with which one of the patriarchs gets sent away. But anyway, it's, she didn't want him to marry one of the pagans. Right. But he even goes out and says, this is the part where we would never read in our Christmas letters. And they made life bitter for Isaac and Rebecca. This was actually a great heartache for them. And we aren't given a lot of the details, but I think it's easy enough to read between the lines that, they married pagan, he married pagan women, and exactly to the contrary to the desire of his own parents. And that's going to prove to be problematic later on down the line.
Yeah, absolutely. And the fact that he marries two right off the bat like this, I think this is the first time we've heard about this sort of explicit sort of polygamy. We did hear since Genesis chapter 4, when it happened in the line of Cain with one of his descendants named Lamech, he takes two wives right away.
Right.
And granted, Abraham, you have the thing that happened with Hagar, which wasn't good, but maybe not quite as blatant as this one. All of it is to say, especially when you throw in Moses' comment there at the end of the chapter, this isn't a good thing that's being recorded here in terms of Esau's actions, and it sets the stage for what is to come in the story of Isaac's children, Esau and Jacob. Our text ends there, though, today. We got about a minute left. Pastor Johnson, help us to wrap things up and point us to Christ from chapter 26.
Right. I mean, the things aren't all tied up, like you just said. You know, it continues to kind of be messy, and yet, but as we pointed out at the very beginning, the line is being preserved. The promise is not failing. And I mean, this is just one little tiny puzzle piece in the grand narrative, you know, that we see that started all the way back in Genesis 3 of how is this all going to work out? How is the one who's going to crush Satan's head? How's he going to come about? And we got to remember, these are all just pages in the story of ultimately the one who's going to come for us and fulfill all things. And so the Lord's being faithful here. He's never going to drop the ball.
Pastor Jeremiah Johnson serves at Glory of Christ Lutheran Church in Plymouth, Minnesota. He's been helping us today to study Genesis chapter 26, verses 1 to 35. Pastor Johnson, thanks for being our guest today.
Hey, thank you.
I am your host here on Sharper Iron, Pastor Timothy Apple of Faith Lutheran Church in Godfrey, Illinois. If you have any questions about Genesis 26, send an email to kfuo@kfuo.org. It is always a joy to hear from you. Join us again next week as we continue to read the book of Genesis. On Monday, we will begin chapter 27 to hear about a very important incident in the lives of Isaac's two sons, Esau and Jacob. Thanks for spending the morning with us today. Talk with you again next week.
Showing support for KFUO is now easier than ever. You can sport a KFUO shirt, swag, or even socks by visiting our online store. Go to kfuo.org/store and order high-quality KFUO-branded merch. You no longer need to wait for our annual share-a-thon for a chance to show your KFUO spirit. Visually share and wear this ministry out in the world by checking out our selection. Every purchase helps to support our proclamation of Christ for you, anytime, anywhere. Go to kfuo.org/store.